WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville.
The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
4 years ago, UN inspectors concluded that Iraq had failed to amount for large stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. In last month's declaration, Iraq again failed to account for those weapons.
The real threat to peace is Saddam Hussein and his possession of weapons of mass destruction.
Saddam Hussein has got weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is a threat to America.
We're resting our case on the fact that Saddam Hussein has developed weapons of mass destruction, has them in his possession.
We just discovered undeclared chemical warheads in Iraq.
I believe Saddam Hussein is a threat to the American people. I believe he's a threat to the neighborhood in which he lives. And I've got good evidence to believe that.
The declaration that he made is proof positive that he has withheld information about his weapons of mass destruction program.
Saddam Hussein possesses some of the world's deadliest weapons.
It's because Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction, and that is the core of the issue.
We're threatened by the spread of chemical and biological and nuclear weapons. Every free nation is a potential target.
The world is increasingly seeing this from the United States' point of view, that Saddam Hussein must disarm.
Saddam Hussein must disarm himself of all weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is not disarming.
He's not disarming.
Saddam Hussein is not disarming. He is a danger to the world.
We know what a disarmed country looks like. And Iraq doesn't look like that.
Secretary of State Powell will present information and intelligence about Iraq's illegal weapons programs.
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. There can be no doubt that Saddam Hussein has biological weapons and the capability to rapidly produce more, many more. And he has the ability to dispense these lethal poisons and diseases in ways that can cause massive death and destruction. Most of the launchers and warheads have been hidden in large groves of palm trees. This is evidence, not conjecture. This is true.
Some of the statements made by administration figures to justify the invasion of Iraq, lies from start to finish. The benefit of the doubt that these claims were honest mistakes or so-called intelligence failures have been definitively put to rest by the release of what have come to be called the Downing Street Minutes. And last Wednesday, Representative Maurice Hinchey of New York's 22nd Congressional District held a community forum in Binghamton to discuss the implications of the revelations. That's coming up on the program. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Several hundred people packed into the Christ Episcopal Church in Binghamton last Thursday to hear Hinchey's presentation. When he came to the front to speak, the audience rose to give him an extended standing ovation. Congressman Maurice Hinchey.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I want to express my very deep appreciation to Father John. Father, thank you very, very much for your hospitality, for allowing us to be here this evening. I deeply appreciate it. And I want to say thank you to all of you for being with us this evening. Thanks for coming out. I am very grateful to you, and thank you very much for that reception. It was very, very touching, and I appreciate it very much. I want to talk a little bit tonight, as you know, about the so-called Downing Street memos. Now, the Downing Street memos are important to us because they reveal in an official way information that cryptically and surreptitiously has been available to us. But now that information is available to us in an official capacity, because these so-called Downing Street memos were written by members of the administration of Prime Minister Tony Blair in Great Britain. They were written either to the Prime Minister himself, or they were written to each other to inform each other about meetings that they attended or were involved in prior to the invasion of Iraq during that period of time leading up to the Iraq War. So they're very important in that regard. Some people have attempted to dismiss these Downing Street memos by saying, well, there's nothing new in them. Well, the fact of the matter is, there is something very new in them, and what is very new in them is just what I said. These are memos written by the highest level ranking officials in the Blair government in Great Britain. And they have to do with their concerns, their skepticism, their understanding of the falsity of the actions that were being taken by representatives of the Bush administration during that period of time leading up to the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. The most famous of these memos now, and the most famous statement from the memos, is one written by Richard Dearlove, who is the head, was at that time, the head of M16. M16 is the chief intelligence operation within the British government. It is even more central than our Central Intelligence Agency, because M16 has jurisdiction over all of the intelligence operations within the British government, whereas in our government, we have a variety of intelligence agencies, not just the Central Intelligence Agency. So this particular memo written by Mr. Dearlove, among other things, says the following. After his meeting with Richard Tenet, the then head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and Condoleezza Rice, the foreign policy advisor for President Bush, his statement in the memo was that with regard to the coming Iraq war, the intelligence and the facts are being fixed around the policy. This is the clear statement from the head of British intelligence that the policy was put in place first, and then the intelligence was being distorted, twisted, manipulated to fit around the policy to justify an attack on Iraq. Now, in order to understand this completely, I think it's important to put it in context. So if you don't mind, I'd like to take just a few moments to step back a little bit in history, to examine the relationship between the United States government during the administration of this president and preceding presidents. In order to understand why these conditions exist between the Bush administration and Iraq, one has to understand those previous relationships. And I'll be very, very brief about this, but I think it's important. During the Iraq-Iran War, which began 1981, during the Iraq-Iran War, Donald Rumsfeld was sent to Iraq to meet with Saddam Hussein. He was sent there by then Secretary of State George Shultz. George Shultz had been the chief of the Bechtel Corporation prior to coming back into the government. The Bechtel Corporation was interested in building an oil pipeline across Iraq to the Red Sea. George Shultz sent Donald Rumsfeld over there, and Rumsfeld went at the end of 83, the beginning of 84, met with Saddam Hussein twice, began to negotiate the building of this pipeline. In the context of those negotiations, the American government agreed to supply the Saddam Hussein government with various forms of equipment and materials, including standard weaponry, and to arrange for them to get other forms of weapons, including chemical and biological weapons. That process continued. The sending of weaponry directly from the United States in some cases, and in other cases from other countries, from France, from Italy, from the Union of South Africa, from Chile, and from other places. Various armaments were sent under United States authorization and jurisdiction during the latter part of the second Reagan administration and during the administration of George H.W. Bush, the first part of that administration. Now, it's important to understand that because when these people speak of Iraq having weapons of mass destruction, in some measure, they knew what they were talking about because they were the suppliers. They had the receipts, if you will, for those weaponries, those weapon systems. Now, the first Iraq war happened in a very sort of odd way. One day, Saddam Hussein called in the American ambassador and said, "We believe that Kuwait should not exist, that it really is a false country, it's really part of Iraq. We have all the jurisdiction to it, and we are thinking about asserting that authority over Kuwait." The American ambassador consulted with the Department of State, and after several meetings with the Saddam Hussein on that subject, consulted continuously with our Department of State, and the final message to the Iraqi president from the American government was, "The American government has no opinion with regard to differences between Iraqi governments." Saddam Hussein took that as a clear signal that if he were to attack Kuwait, no one was going to stand in his way, and so he did so. And then, for other reasons, including a meeting that occurred between President George H.W. Bush and Margaret Thatcher out in Colorado, President George H.W. Bush decided to attack Iraq, drove them out of Kuwait, and we had the first Gulf War. Now, the people who were in, many of them in the Reagan administration and the administration of George H.W. Bush, a number of them were in the administration of George W. Bush. And it has been their intention ever since the 1980s to invade Iraq and to overturn the government there. In fact, in 1998, a number of those people signed a letter to then-President Bill Clinton telling him why they thought he should invade Iraq. Of course, he never did so. But President Clinton did maintain the no-fly zones in both the north of Iraq and the south of Iraq, which were put into place after the first Iraq war. According to information coming out of the first meeting of the National Security Council of President George W. Bush, at that meeting, the president, when he was informed that the biggest problem that he would confront during his presidency was the problem of international terrorism and the Al-Qaeda network. The president changed the subject to Iraq at the very first meeting of the National Security Council. So, Iraq has been on the mind of this president from the very beginning. Then came the attack by Al-Qaeda on the United States, September 11, 2001, at the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. There was a horrendous attack which resulted in the death of more than 3,000 people. Instead of responding in the appropriate way, the administration tried to involve Iraq in that attack. Now, the administration did one right thing. They recognized that Al-Qaeda was housed in Afghanistan, that the Taliban were hosting the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan at that moment, and after appealing to the Taliban to surrender Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban refusing to do so, the administration did, in this instance, in my opinion, the right thing. They went after the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan to try to ensure that the people who perpetrated the attack against us on September 11th would not be able to do that again anywhere to anyone. However, shortly after that, the administration turned its focus away from Afghanistan back toward Iraq. And in doing so, the administration came to the American Congress and the American people and repeatedly made the argument that Iraq was somehow involved with the attack of September 11th, and that there was some working relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Now, we know from the analyses that have been done by the 9/11 Commission, by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and others, that none of that was true. Iraq had nothing whatsoever to do with the attack of September 11th, and there was no working relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. In fact, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden had an antagonistic relationship. As that argument began to fade, the administration began to concentrate on something which they thought was more palpable, something that they thought was real and that they could prove: weapons of mass destruction. The administration repeatedly made the argument that Iraq had what they called weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons, and was in the process of developing a nuclear weapon. Now, under United Nations resolution, weapons inspection teams had been in Iraq for a period of time, searching for chemical and biological weapons, and also to see if there was any evidence that there were the beginning of a nuclear weapon program. Those weapons inspection teams from the United Nations found no evidence whatsoever that there were any of these weapon systems anywhere in the country. Subsequently, the United States sent in two separate additional weapons inspection teams of our own, searched the country exhaustively, found no evidence of chemical or biological weapons, no evidence of any kind of a nuclear weapons program whatsoever. All the evidence indicated that roughly one-third of the chemical and biological and other weapons that the United States government under the presidencies of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, all of the weaponry systems that had been supplied to Iraq during that period of time, one-third of those systems, roughly, approximately, had been destroyed during the first Gulf War, and the remaining two-thirds were found by the United Nations weapons inspection teams and destroyed. No evidence of any weapons of mass destruction anywhere. Yet, the Bush administration continued to insist that they were there. At one point, now famously, the President of the United States stood before a joint session of the Congress and said that they knew Iraq was developing a nuclear weapons program because they were importing enriched uranium from Niger, a country in West Africa. That statement was doubted by everyone who knew anything about the uranium program in Niger, because the uranium program in Niger is run by Western European countries, not by the country of Niger. Nevertheless, the Central Intelligence Agency asked a former ambassador, Ambassador Wilson, to travel to Niger, an ambassador who had experience in Africa and also experience in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East, to travel to Niger to investigate whether or not there was any possibility that enriched uranium from Niger had been sent to Iraq. Ambassador Wilson went there, conducted his investigation, came back and reported to the Central Intelligence Agency that there was no indication whatsoever that any enriched uranium had been sent out of Niger to Iraq. And of course, no enriched uranium has ever been found in Iraq, in spite of these exhaustive searches that have been carried out both by the United Nations and by our own two weapons inspection teams. After Ambassador Wilson made that report to the Central Intelligence Agency, people within the Bush administration began to try to counter it in various ways. So Ambassador Wilson wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times. That op-ed piece in the New York Times stated what he had been asked to do, how he did it, and what he found. No evidence of any uranium going out of Niger to Iraq, contrary to the statement made by the President of the United States. Well, you know what happened after that. Ambassador Wilson's wife, who was an operator for the Central Intelligence Agency, had her identity revealed, thereby placing her life in jeopardy. And we have now a court case involving two reporters, one for Time magazine, the other for the New York Times, asking them to reveal their sources, in spite of the fact that the reporter for the New York Times never wrote anything about it. But that court case now is still ongoing. And Robert Novak, the so-called conservative columnist, revealed in his column, he was the only one to do so, revealed in his column the identity of Valerie Plame, the wife of Ambassador Wilson. And it was that revelation that, in fact, put her life in danger. So now we have these Downing Street memos. The Downing Street memos were written over a period of time beginning in early 2002. The discussions between Great Britain and the United States governments began late in 2001 and went on into 2002. These memos come out in the early part of 2002 talking about the skepticism that high-ranking British officials have with regard to the plans of the Bush administration to invade Iraq, stating clearly that they could see no justification for it, and that it was a policy which was going to lead to very great difficulties, and that the administration had no idea what they might do after the attack of Iraq. And all of that now increasingly is becoming more and more clear to all of the American people, that the administration falsified so-called evidence and information in order to justify an attack against Iraq to remove the government there, not for any reasons that had anything to do with our national security, but only for the private, personal, and political reasons of George W. Bush and his administration, and for no other reason. And now we find ourselves enmeshed in a circumstance that is getting more and more difficult every month. Last May, there were 10 insurgency acts in Iraq. 12 months later, in the same month, there were 70 insurgency actions. That activity is growing. It is becoming more and more difficult. As I mentioned, more than 1,750 men and women killed, more than 1,500 of those killed since the president flew onto the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln just off the coast of San Diego and announced mission accomplished. Well, the mission was never really defined, honestly. And the mission has not been accomplished, and we continue to lose more and more people there, and our reputation in the world continues to decline, and the difficulty of the situation continues to grow. We need an honest evaluation of this situation. We need a Congress of the United States which is prepared to carry out its responsibilities under the Constitution to oversee the actions of the executive branch. We have a unilateral government in Washington today, one where there is no constitutional oversight or examination by the Congress. The Congress has simply acquiesced in everything essentially that the administration has decided to do, rather than to exercise their powers to conduct congressional hearings, to issue subpoenas, to bring in people and question them. Why did we not take appropriate precautions prior to September 11th, in spite of the fact that the president was told over and over again that Al-Qaeda was determined to attack the United States? Why did the United States attack Iraq when Iraq posed no harm or danger to us, no national security issues were involved at all? Why did we attack that country? For no good reason, unjustly, unfairly, contrary to international law, contrary to our own Constitution. Why isn't the Congress of the United States asking those questions? Why isn't the Congress of the United States asking, why are we acting so corruptly with regard to this occupation? Why are we allowing certain companies, Kellogg Brown and Root, for example, to exploit hundreds of millions of dollars illegally in the conduct of this occupation? Why are we allowing that kind of essential criminal activity to go on without appropriate intervention by the Congress? Why isn't the Congress asking the administration, what are your plans? Do you have a plan to extricate our servicemen, our military people, from Iraq? What are your long-term plans? What are your short-term plans? None of those questions are being asked appropriately by this Congress. And because they are not doing so, our Constitution is being put in jeopardy. But we continue to be deluged with information that is falsified. There was an interesting story on the front page of the Press and Sun Bulletin today with the title Analysis, which created a whole mythology. At one point, they're suggesting that the price of oil is going to go up to $120 a barrel if we leave Iraq. Absolutely absurd. Saying that the insurgency is going to get worse if we leave Iraq. The insurgency is getting worse and worse by the hour, practically, in Iraq, as we stay there. But that kind of information flows out of the administration and finds its way onto television and radio and even in newspapers. And it is presenting an increasing challenge for the American people to be able to discern the facts amidst all of this propaganda that we are getting. This administration has hired people to promote its policies in the general media. They paid one person $241,000 to promote the No Child Left Behind Act during the last presidential campaign. They paid another reporter more than $21,000 to promote some of the administration's social policies. But the biggest payment went to a public relations firm, which was paid to create among the general public the ideas that would justify an attack on Iraq. This particular company, called the Rendon Group, was paid right after the attack of September 11, $100,000 a month to promote the idea that Iraq had something to do with the attack of September 11th and that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That's why we saw in those polls so many people across the country, particularly out in the red states, where we don't know how they get their information, but somehow, particularly out there in that part of the country, 3/4 of those people when they were polled said that Saddam Hussein had something to do with the attack of September 11th, and almost the same number said there were weapons of mass destruction. Because of the fact that this administration is spending our taxpayers' dollars to promote propaganda, to promote a system of falsehoods and lies to the American people to attempt to justify their actions. And the Downing Street memos show that more clearly than any other items that we have seen. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is up to all of us, in each of our own way, to understand these situations as best we can, to discern the truth, to see the lies, and to speak out against them at every available opportunity. I am doing that as your representative in the Congress of the United States. I will continue to do it at every opportunity, both here in our district and in Washington. I will continue to do it until we have a situation in Washington where we are getting the truth, whether it comes as a result of a new election, whether it comes as a result of changes that need to be made, or in whatever way. But we cannot allow this democratic republic to be placed in this very difficult and dangerous circumstance. If we allow this administration to get away with this, then our republic has become substantially weaker. And a subsequent administration may do more, may do even worse. Saw what happened in Europe in the 1930s. How fascist powers came to office and used the media, the radio then, exclusively to dominate the airwaves with their message over and over and over and over again. and how that put them in power and kept them in power in places like Spain and Italy and Germany and elsewhere. We need in this country a free, open, fair media that is going to deliver the truth about what goes on in our government. And we need to insist that this administration give us a plan to end the war in Iraq, to get our military people out of there soundly, safely, securely, intelligently, and as soon as possible. The means of doing that are available to us. We have allies through the United Nations that will provide the means by which we can, over a period of time, move our troops out and others in, while the Iraqi government develops the strength that it needs to organize its country and to carry out government activities in an appropriate way. But the longer we stay there, the more we are seen as an occupying force. No occupying force in the history of civilization has ever been accepted by the nation being occupied. The only thing that has happened is that over time, the hostility and resentment toward the occupying force grows and increases, and the level of violence grows and increases with it. And that's what we are seeing now in Iraq and will continue to see, so long as this administration is not honest with the American people. We have information that they are planning 4 permanent bases in Iraq. That is unacceptable. Should be unacceptable to us, should be and it is unacceptable to the Iraqi people. Just last week, 82 members of the Iraqi Congress, which was elected just a year ago, 82 members signed a petition asking the United States military to begin to leave. This administration has got to face up to the facts. It's got to be honest with the people of this country, honest in the way that it carries out its policies. And in doing so, we need to develop a plan to remove ourselves from that country and to establish a stable government. I thank you very much for being here this evening. If anyone has any questions or has anything to say to me, any statements, I'll be happy to try to answer the questions and listen to the statements. Thanks very much.
Congressman Maurice Hinchey speaking in Binghamton.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for being our representative. I'm very grateful to have you here in our community and representing this district. I'm very disappointed in the Democratic senators from this state, Clinton and Schumer, who have not spoken up as well as you have against the war in Iraq. But I would respectfully like to take issue with what you said about our invasion of Iraq for no good reason. I would argue that, on the contrary, the war in Iraq is going very much as planned and is going swimmingly well for certain people. If you want to control the world's largest oil reserves and be able to manipulate the price of oil and profit from the high prices of oil, we're doing really well. If you're looking to create permanent military bases in the Middle East and surrounding regions, we're doing really, really well. If you'd like to threaten other Middle East countries with a sudden invasion, our plan is working. If you like to play ball with the Saudi family and Saudi Arabia by reducing our presence there, then it's going exactly as planned. If you want to intimidate and threaten other countries who we deem unfriendly to our interests, it's going perfectly.
If we want to prove our disrespect for the rule of law in the United Nations and other allied countries, not to mention those 35 million people who demonstrated a month before the invasion and were considered by our president to be a focus group, and also prove that you can do so without so far suffering any consequences, let alone the serious consequences that are required, go Conyers, right? If you want to create a massive military worldwide prison system at Guantanamo, Puerto Rico, by the way, most people don't know about the prisons we have in Puerto Rico, onboard ships for the detention of foreign and domestic persons, well, this war is a great way to do it. If you're looking to support the tyranny of other dictatorships, such as Saudi Arabia or Uzbekistan, this is a wonderful way. So I take exception for the fact that there's no reason at all, because Bush may be an inarticulate, ill-informed about world events, a born-again Christian who's catering to the most virulent, hateful aspects of religious intolerance. But he's surrounded by extremely intelligent and insidious schemers with an agenda. I believe, personally, that the agenda is global dominance of the reserves of oil that exist on this planet, instilling fear and terror into the hearts of populations overseas and at home, and controlling the dissension of millions of people both abroad, but particularly here in the USA, whose goals include tolerance for diversity and world peace. And lastly, the transfer of uncountless sums of wealth from taxpayers, who, by the way, don't include most of your large corporations, from the middle and lower classes to the rich and powerful by siphoning off hundreds of billions of dollars for the military control of our planet. So in that case, in that sense, the war's going great.
That's absolutely right. And of course, if I didn't, I should have said no honest reason or no real good reason. But there were their own reasons. And that's why I suggested that this war was done only for the private, personal, and political reasons of George W. Bush, his family, and the people around him. There was a recent article in Fortune magazine which talked about one of the great difficulties that was being confronted by one of the major oil companies, ExxonMobil, in our country. It is a very, very difficult problem, and they have not yet resolved how to deal with it. The problem is they have too much cash. They have too much money. When we think of the price of oil going up, we have been conditioned to think about how OPEC is benefiting from the rising cost of oil. But we don't stop to think often about how domestic oil companies, the people who own stock in those domestic oil companies and who are involved in those domestic oil companies, the way the Bush family is, are also making very, very substantial amounts of money, confronting with and then having themselves confronted with this very difficult problem of having so much cash they just don't know what to do with it. That's the problem that the oil companies are facing today. So the story in the Press and Sun today about $120 oil, if we stay in Iraq, is just the opposite. We're going to face increasing oil prices no matter what happens, frankly, based upon the energy policies of this administration, which are based almost exclusively on giving tax breaks, more and more tax breaks, more and more financial incentives to the fossil fuel industry, particularly the oil industry. That's the way the energy bill was when it passed the House of Representatives. The Senate is doing a much better job on their energy bill, and we'll see if anything comes out of it. But the points that you make are excellent ones, and they are exactly what those people had in mind when they began this initiative, and I thank you very much.
I respect the disagree with some of the things you have said. One week after the initial invasion of Iraq, I watched Hans Blix be asked by Peter Zenger on the NBC. Hans Blix, of course, is very impacted. He's not paid for by the administration. He said point blank that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. That, just the fact that other countries, other approaches, agencies, did confirm the fact that Saddam did have weapons of mass destruction. We informed the thousands of years of nerve gas and cyanide weapons that dispersed throughout the 1960s period when that human inspector was dead. So I respect the instrument. Anyone who says that weapons of mass destruction did not exist, they did exist. They were confirmed by one of the people, just the administration people. Now, you know, you can respect the disagree about what's the best way to handle the situation, but at the same time, you know, when I hear that people say that weapons of mass destruction didn't exist, and there's a mountain of evidence to prove that they did, why should I listen to anything that you have to say on any other
question is that Hans Blix at a certain moment said that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Hans Blix did say at a certain moment that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I talked about that earlier in what I said here just a few minutes ago. Those weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, conventional weapons, were supplied by the Reagan administration, by the administration of George H.W. Bush prior to the first Gulf War. We worked through various American agencies surreptitiously. For example, through the Commodities Credit Corporation, vast amounts of pesticides were sent from the United States to Iraq. Iraq then used those pesticides as chemical weapons against the Iranians and probably against the Kurds. There were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They were sent there by two American administrations during the 1980s. During the 1980s, up to 1990, even into early 1991. The point is that there were no weapons of mass destruction left in Iraq when we announced the invasion. All of those weapons of mass destruction were destroyed, found by the weapons inspection team, taken out of the country. There are no weapons of mass, no chemical or biological weapons in Iraq. I'll tell you another little story. The Reagan administration, at one point, disassembled two factories in the southern part of the United States, Arizona and Texas, took those factories down to Chile, reassembled them down there, and built cluster bombs in those factories. Those cluster bombs were then sent to Iraq. This was another way in which those two administrations supplied substantial amounts of weaponry to the Iraqi government. So, as I said earlier, we sent substantial amounts of chemical and biological as well as conventional weapons into Iraq during the Iran War, and we continued to do so right on up to the advent of the first Gulf War in 1991. But when the Bush administration invaded Iraq in March of 2003, there were no weapons left in Iraq. All of them had been found, destroyed, and taken out. So be very clear about that, and you can believe that and everything else I say because it's true.
Thank you very much for coming here. We're always glad to see you and glad to hear what you have to say. All of this is history. What I would like to know is what is going to be happening with the Democratic Congress toward, number one, getting Bush out, or if not that, then what are we going to do about the Downing Street memo and various other points that you have mentioned? What can be done by the Democratic members of our Congress who are elected? What are they actually going to do?
Okay, well, that's a very good question and a very important one. We are doing things, but we cannot do the kinds of things that are most effective. And that the reason for that is that we're in the minority. The Republican Party controls both houses of the Congress. They control every single committee. They control all of the buildings. They control all of the rooms. And so it is very difficult for us to do anything. No Democrat has the power of subpoena because there are no Democrats in the majority on any committees. The Republicans control all of the committees in the Congress. Nevertheless, we are doing some things. John Conyers, who is the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, held a hearing on the Downing Street memos a couple of weeks ago. And originally, that meeting was to be held at the Democratic headquarters, a couple of blocks away, because the Republicans would not give him or any of us even one room in the Congress, either in any of the office buildings or in the Congress itself. Finally, under pressure, they changed and they gave us a small room in the basement of the Capitol, HC9, tiny room in the basement of the Capitol, where that hearing was held. And that hearing got a considerable amount of attention. It is the first in a series of hearings which will be held in that way. I attended that hearing, made my statement, asked questions of the witnesses that appeared there. That kind of activity is going to continue. And I and others will continue to take every chance that we get during debates on legislation that comes to the floor of the House to bring these issues up. It's very difficult to do so because the Republicans control the time on every single bill that comes to the floor of the House of Representatives. Not that way in the Senate, but in the House, every single bill that comes to the floor of the House of Representatives has attached to it a rule. That rule controls the amount of time for debate on the bill, how many, if any, amendments can be allowed to be offered, and various other restrictions and restraints that are put on the legislation. We don't have an open government anymore. We don't have open debate because the Republican Party has shut it down. But we will continue to take every opportunity that we have to bring these issues out in the context of debate on the floor and in the context of special orders, the times after the Congress adjourns for the day when we can take to the floor and talk about these and other issues that are important to the American people. We'll continue to do that in every way that we can. And we need to ask the American people to focus closely and carefully on the election of 2006. The election of 2006 is one of the most important elections in the history of our country. It will determine whether or not we continue to have a Congress that will acquiesce to the deceits and fraudulent activities and unlawful activities of an administration, or are we going to elect a different kind of Congress in 2006, which will stand up to the administration, conduct appropriate congressional hearings, subpoena administration officials, insist that they answer the questions so that we can get to the truth about all of the issues that we've been discussing here this evening.
Perfect segue, Mr. Hinchey, because meanwhile, back at the ranch, people have not given up investigating how the last elections were conducted. And I'm going to tell you, I have been following this. Those elections were fraudulent. And there is no reason to think that if you rig an election to take the presidency, you won't do it with senators and Congress members and anywhere else you can get in these easily tamperable voting machines. So I guess my question is, I, as a citizen, don't have any confidence in the electoral system, no matter who I might actually think I voted for, to end up with an outcome that is going to do anything to change this. So I guess one of my suggestions is, what else can the American people do to bring pressure on these people in government to either, you know, act properly or get out?
The thing to do is to bring pressure on your elected representatives at all levels, from the local level up to the federal level, to make sure, as best you can, that they understand your concerns and that they will act in accordance with those concerns. And also, there are people in power in this country today who are trying to destroy the confidence of the American people in the electoral system. They want people to stay home. They want people to believe that your vote doesn't count. They want people to believe that no matter what you do, it's not going to change things. If we ever begin to give into that, that's the beginning of the end. Every vote counts. We need to be sure that we remain active in the electoral process. Don't ever give into the idea that you're not important and the votes don't count. We've got to make sure that these elections are carried off honestly and carefully. And the best way to do that is for all of us to be involved and to make sure that we all go to the polls, make sure that we vote, make sure that we participate in the electoral process in every possible way. That's the best thing that we can do to maintain our citizenship and maintain the integrity of this republic.
Increasingly, the polls are showing that the American people are no longer supporting the war. Do you not think it would be important for the Democrats to come up with a plan to get us out of it? I think the polls are also showing that the people do want the troops to come home. Why don't the Democrats come forth with a plan of their own? And I think that they will get the coverage if they do that, something like that.
Well, we're in the process of developing a plan. We have just formed an Out of Iraq caucus, and in the context of that caucus, we are developing such a plan. And we will present that plan to other members of the Congress, and we hope that the plan will be acceptable to other members of the Congress and to the American people. You're right. We have to have a plan. It has to be a sensible plan. I've suggested that here this evening on a couple of occasions. And that's what we need to do, and we need to present that plan to the Congress and the American people.
As Congressman, are you prudent to, number one, the hard number in terms of Iraqis that have died since the war began?
Say again.
Do you have a hard number in terms of how many Iraqis have died since the war began? Is there any sort of record keeping regarding that? And number two, is there any similar experiences to soldiers coming home from the Gulf War, experiencing things like Gulf War syndrome, that sort of thing, in the last couple of years?
The question is, do we have any hard numbers with regard to the number of Iraqi people who have died as a result of the war? And secondly, is there any evidence of military personnel coming home showing evidence of Gulf War syndrome? We do not have a hard number with regard to the number of Iraqi casualties. The speculation and belief is that that number is up over 100,000. International agencies on the ground doing analysis have come up with that number, more than 100,000, most of those civilians who have been killed. That's another example of tragic consequences of this war and why our presence there is deeply resented. With regard to Gulf War syndrome, yes, there is very substantial evidence of people coming home with Gulf War syndrome, which is a title for something that is not clearly understood. And one of the causes, in all likelihood, of Gulf War syndrome is something called depleted uranium, which is being used on warheads to strengthen those warheads against armored defense systems. And I think that one of the things that I'm trying to do, along with some others, a few others in the Congress, is to get additional attention paid to this so that we can discover what is going on here. It's a similar situation to Vietnam veterans coming home with Vietnam syndrome, which was largely associated with exposure to Agent Orange and other chemical pesticides which were used to defoliate the jungles, and the use of other materials as well. So there is work going on that, and we will continue to do it. Yes, sir.
Congressman, thank you very much for taking a leadership in Congress, and you have been one of the major leaders in opposition to this war right from the start. It is interesting as well that your district has the only trial coming up against dissenters, federal trial in the United States. There have been city trials, county trials. There has not been a federal trial against dissenters to the war. Now, your inspiration has been great in many ways. But there are some people who have not been able to be successful in writing letters to the editor, in visiting congressmen or senators, and doing all the good things. And when they saw this war coming 2 days before the war started, they saw it coming many days before, they did a dramatic act, something whereby they did not burn bodies, they did not blow up buildings, they did not cause destruction, they did not spend billions of dollars or waste American dollars. They took their own blood and they poured it on a flag inside of the American, U.S. military recruiting station in Ithaca, Lansing, New York. They poured it on the floor. They were saying, we must give a wake-up call. We have done everything possible and we have not been able to move people. They said, where is the outrage? Stop before the killing starts. They will be across the street on September 19th for this first federal trial in the United States against dissenters. That's September 19th, and during the evening hours, there will be a tribunal. We invite you, Congressman Hinchey, to please come and say a few words, just be with the people. They have a possibility of 6 years in prison, individuals who are giving the call, and that's basically the not so much a question, but an invitation.